Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, April 25th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Ladies and gentlemen, it's one of our famous vacation weeks where we take vacation and you still get new content. Today's a little bit different. As you know, as a part of trying to enhance our ability to make this show a success, we here at Majority.fm have begun to launch some other shows. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. This is not a guaranteed hit-making machine, ladies and gentlemen. If we were, we would be called hitmakingmachine.fm, but we're not. So, ladies and gentlemen, what is the show that we have for you today? It is actually a taster of
a teaser.
Thank you. Of Two Dope Boys. What is Two Dope Boys? Well, it is a show co-hosted by Michael Brooks and Philip McKenzie, along with their crew, as it were, and produced by our very own Matt Leck. And they cover, trends, media phenomena, phenomena that exist in, like, amongst, like, marketing and brands. Like, they did a show last week on the coordinated journalism of the Panama Papers leak. But they'll also do one on, you know, Stephen Curry endorsing water over soda.
Steph Curry.
Steph Curry. Amazing basketball player. They'll do a myriad of different things, topics that we don't talk about. Well, somebody just described it very well, and I can't remember who it was in what context, but it was something about like Fast Company meets Jacobin or something like that.
Yeah, correct.
And I thought that was pretty good. Of course, neither one of those are podcasts. But nevertheless, ladies and gentlemen, we wanted to give you a taste of the show because I want to convince you all to subscribe. When you subscribe and download the show and listen to it and enjoy it and tell your friends, you are helping out this show as well as that show. Because the idea is that, you know, we know there's a limit on, you know, we sell ads against a Majority Report, but we know the show has a limit. I mean, even at the highest downloaded shows in the news and politics division of iTunes is dwarfed by the non-news and politics sections, society and culture. So the idea is that we want to put some other shows out there to help support this one. And this is a show that I think is really, it's clicking, as they say in the business. And then what we do is we ask Matt to take out that clicking noise. Oh, my God. So enjoy this episode. I don't know what it is. It's Matt's choice. Matt's like in charge now. Like, I gave him the keys to the car, and now this is like Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And so, speaking of things that are trending, folks, after you listen to this show, you could do this beforehand, but you're going to certainly want to do it at any point. Listen to the show and then go to Two Dope Boys, the number spelling out T-W-O, Dope Boys Pod.com. You can find all this in the show notes for today's thing. But at Two Dope Boys, we're going to make it even clearer on how you subscribe. That's one of the first things that we should put on a on a podcast page is how to subscribe a button. But this has been a learning experience for all of us, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so enjoy this. Tomorrow, this week, we've got some great pre-recorded shows for you. Thomas Frank, Meg Jacobs, who wrote about Panic at the Pump, a great sort of companion reader to some of the stuff that that Rick Perlstein has done about the development of the conservative movement in the 70s. Joseph Singer, who turns out to be one of my former law professors. That moment where I tell him on air, like, you are my former law professor. And what else do we? Well, you'll find out what else we have for you. A book about the history of abolition. Fascinating stuff. So enjoy this week's pre-tape shows. And we'll also have some deep archive stuff for members that will be Matt's pick. Stuff from the deep, deep archive. All right, enjoy this episode, this teaser of Two Dope Boys.
Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
Two Dope Boys is a shout out from the margins. Each week, we will break down trends using the lens of culture to shed light on what's impactful to your future and why.
And on this week's edition of Dope Boys, we have another esteemed and amazing and talented member of our crew, Biz Gormley.
Busy B.
Busy B. Tell us about yourself, Biz, please.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me here, guys. I'm excited to be part of the crew, get to know everybody a bit better, and also just to be part of these conversations. A little bit about me. I am a lady of many trades these days. I'm originally from Boston area, been in New York a dozen years, and right now I'm mostly focusing on investigating, writing, helping try and change the way philanthropy works, and helping people start companies. So all over the place, but good times.
Biz keeps me honest. When I got questions, when I'm wondering, like, am I messing up? I email her, and she puts me straight.
Well, appreciated. Likewise, Phil helps me go beyond the sound bites. I got a lot of good long-form reads from our friendship over the years. So I'm
No doubt.
Appreciating your endorsement.
Yeah, and I'm honored to get in on this friendship as well. It's been awesome to get to know you, Biz.
Yeah, definitely. Likewise.
Yeah, it's been really, really great. And
just the beginning.
Just the beginning. And it's a little bit awkward because this is a genuine, beautiful moment we just had here on the show. And now we're about to transition into the brand F-up of the week.
Speaking of honesty.
Yeah, this is so you know, every week on the show, this is what we do. We're scanning out on the horizon. We're finding brands. We're finding people that have effed up. We're telling you the story. We're telling you usually their apology, because usually there's been some sort of apology, and then we're reviewing it. And this week we have a kind of interesting one, because this involves Bobby D, Robert De Niro, who, as I say in my customary Dave Chappelle reference for each podcast, Robert De Niro is like, brings out the Dave Chappelle sketch that Phil and I talk about so much, where he basically is on all of these hypothetical jury situations with famous black cases, Michael Jackson, OJ, R. Kelly, and he's just like, no, like, video could have been fake, not guilty. So that's basically my kind of white equivalent. I'm like, and then he's like, Michael Jackson, like, he made Thriller. And so for me, I'm like,
Thriller.
He was in Goodfellas. That's my white equivalent. So basically, yeah, Bobby D cannot be guilty ever. But that said, he got himself into some trouble as part of the Tribeca Film Festival, because he was basically had initially approved the screening of a film called Vaxxed, From Cover Up to Catastrophe, which is written by a guy named and directed by a guy named Andrew Wakefield, who was a physician in the UK who had sort of undertaken studies many years ago that apparently showed a link between autism and vaccines. And those studies have since been debunked, overturned, thoroughly scientifically discredited. And instead of sort of moving on in the scientific process, Wakefield has kind of turned himself into sort of a vaccine conspiracy guru. And that film was kind of part of it. Initially, De Niro defended the film being in the festival as kind of part of a larger debate, which is an interesting way of framing it. Where's the line between debate when you have sort of just out and out falsehood? But he backtracked and basically said, and ended up pulling the film, and this is what he said. He said, "My intent in screening this film was to provide an opportunity for conversation around an issue that is deeply personal for me and my family. But after reviewing it over the past few days with the Tribeca Film Festival teams and others from the scientific community, we do not believe it contributes to or furthers the discussion I had hoped for." So I have my thoughts on this, obviously, not just limited to De Niro, not guilty. But let's open up the floor. Biz, what do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, my first instinct when I'm listening to the story is absolutely a First Amendment kind of argument, freedom for the thought you hate. Where are we creating space for disagreement, discord? But there's definitely a difference between debate and perpetuating falsehood. I haven't seen the movie. I don't know how much it goes into, you know, the facts, the falsehood, or if it's really a propaganda film for this perspective. So it's hard for me to speak on that tip. But in terms of De Niro's play, I think it's interesting to me when these things pop, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was this really the first time they had this conversation? Is this really the first time he thought critically about this issue of whether or not it's a debate? I don't know much about his family either. What is that piece of the statement about? So for me, it's a lot of question marks. You know, a film festival is, especially Tribeca, is a definitely a profit-driven, kind of image-driven, reputation-driven space. So this is not a First Amendment space necessarily.
Right.
There's an agenda. And sitting in the middle of Tribeca, it's definitely trying to be a certain kind of progressive, a certain kind of on point that the vaccine kind of the vaccine autism link is not part of. But how could he have gotten to this point and not have thought of that question is part of what comes up for me.
Mm.
Yeah, I think thinking is the big thing. Like, you know, like
that's the sound drop right there.
Putting aside the apology, which, you know, it was a standard apology. So if we're just rating the apology as like, okay, you did what you needed to do and
right.
you did pull the film. And there is something to be said for trying something out and then realizing this might not be right when you get more information. Because I don't know how much Robert De Niro is involved with the kind of day-to-day of picking films for the film festival. I mean, at this point, Tribeca Film Festival is a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably involved in 5% of the decisions, and then the rest is left to like underlings. He probably thought it would be something that would bring some attention, some buzz, and bluesy blah. Boom, let's rock with the film. On the anti-vaccine
tip, that's how we make decisions at Dope Boys.
Exactly. It's all like, yo, let's rock
bluesy
with
blah.
It. You know, bluesy blah.
Boom.
He did state that he has a child that suffers from autism. So I'm sure that was part of the decision-making process as it pertains to this film. At the end of the day, I'm probably not very sympathetic to like the anti-vaccine movement and people who's kind of subscribe to that. I'm like, come on, son. This is 21st century times. Like, we going back to leeches now? Like,
there's also at the same time, like, the list of vaccines that kids get now. It's just, yeah, it's with the detox oriented.
Yeah, there's a detox one.
Depends on the marketing.
Yeah, that's right.
But, you know, yeah. Maybe the movie doesn't need to be played. Maybe the science is messed up, but like, where are we having actual conversations about these issues?
Yeah, I mean, my final thought on it is I think it's a pretty standard issue apology. My read on it, and I'm not psychic, obviously, which I guess is another point of inquiry, but is that, you know, I think a lot of people, and it's interesting because it's the flip. I mean, you know, mostly the kind of quote unquote anti-scientific perspective is more sort of, you know, non-coastal, and it's on the right, and it's people who are denying the science of like global warming as an example. Clearly a lot of people some people around the kind of Tribeca demo are definitely very skeptical of, you know, of medicine, of vaccines and things like that. So I read it on an apology level. I read it as, if I had to guess, De Niro in his mind thinks that this is a legitimate perspective, but he didn't want to take the heat for it.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I have a friend, Bronwyn Dickey, who I cite and I've interviewed, and, you know, she writes a lot about these issues. And I think one of the most interesting conversations I've had with her is distinguishing between a really rightful skepticism about, you know, the medical industry. One quick example, you know, when I was a kid, and I was in a little town in Massachusetts, a bunch of kids started getting whooping cough. And, you know, there had been vaccinations, so that was not the issue. And then what had emerged was that the company had sold basically like out-of-date vaccines, right? So that's not a question of vaccines. It's a question of like medical honesty. I think the problem is that these things have been conflated. You're getting legitimate questions about the medical establishment and that industry getting conflated with, you know, and or even a question of like, I don't know whether you want to stagger vaccines or whatever, but it seems like really clear that like the autism link specifically, at least from the research that this guy did, is totally debunked. It's just not true. Mm-hmm. And I think the second part of it, from an amendment perspective, like, you know, I get booked on TV sometimes. I want to get booked, you know, all the time. When they choose to not book me on a segment, that's not a violation of my First Amendment rights.
Right.
And people confuse like the access to commercial platforms with your First Amendment. Your First Amendment is your literal right to speech. It's not right to a platform. That's an entirely different thing.
Yeah. And if I can just butt in here, I think given the public health concerns about it,
yes,
that I think they did the right thing in being cautious in this.
Yeah, because it's not like something where, you know, the science around GMOs or whatever, that's a whole other thing to debate. But like, that's the benefits of those technologies are hypothetical, just as mm-hmm. disaster scenarios. With vaccines, even if there is a problem, we know that there is a problem when people are not getting vaccinated because certain diseases are coming back.
Right.
Like, that's not an abstraction. That's an actual public health yeah. problem. And you need to consider that even if you're Tribeca.
Cool.
All right. So now we got to get to what's up. And, you know, we talk a lot on Two Dope Boys about culture. And Phil and I have written about the brand cultural prime directive, how brands and companies relate to culture, how culture evolves and changes, how internal cultures affect how work is produced. And there was a really provocative piece in Fast Company that we came across in researching for this week's show, which made the argument really bluntly, and it's in the title, Why a Negative Work Culture is Better Than No Work Culture at All. And it's a piece written by Vivian Gian, and it was published on March 28th. And she speaks a lot with Victor Ho, who's the CEO of Five Stars, which is a customer loyalty network for small businesses. And he basically, the argument is that a quote, and this is a quote from the article, having a well-defined culture, whether it is good, bad, or ugly, is more important than not having one at all. Ho experienced the need to cultivate a strong culture in his own company about 3 years ago when the company raised a series of A round and talent pool doubled in 3 months. So basically, he goes on to say that even if you're having a culture built on, you know, ruthlessness, exhaustion, competition, things that you know, it's sort of be in the quote unquote negative bucket or not usually in books on how to have a happy and productive organizational culture. That culture is so powerful and so important that even the sort of negative iteration of it as a compass, as an orientation, trumps no culture at all. My questions to kind of open this are, is like, does anything exist that has no culture at all?
Yeah.
That was my kind of first pushback on this. And then secondly, this to me is the type of write-up that's fun and interesting for the conversation and for the article copy. But when it actually translates to like toxicity and abuse in a work environment, what does that actually mean? And then, you know, what are the goals of culture to begin with? So I just wanted to, you know, go wherever you want, obviously, but those were the first kind of things that came to my mind when I read it.
Yeah, that was one of my first thoughts, that I don't know if it's possible to have no culture. Like, culture is being defined in in this article and through this research is a positive thing. Like, it's through a positive lens. And so what they're trying to do is juxtapose a positive culture versus a negative culture. And really, culture is something that's all-encompassing. It's not something that you can drop into neat and easy buckets, because even if you don't have a bunch of things written down as the corporate culture, sort of the guidelines, that in and of itself is a culture. Right. You know, it's saying that we're loose. We don't write those things down, that we are not going to subscribe to a certain amount of things on the wall. Like, Goldman had 10 to 15, I used to work at Goldman Sachs, and they had 10 to 15 principles of what it was like to work at Goldman, as well as a number of informal principles that
were subtle about insider trading.
Yeah, be subtle about those kind of things.
Don't overtly break the law.
It's like a
really Armani preferred to Gucci.
But those were the principles. For example, coming up in the firm, and anyone who's a Goldman alum or currently at Goldman, they've heard the term long-term greedy, you know, which isn't written down anywhere, but that was their way of talking about doing the right thing for clients, in the sense that we're not interested in sort of the short-term gains that come from taking shortcuts, something we talk about a lot, breaking rules.
Right.
It was more about, we want to be long-term greedy. We want to have a relationship with clients that will allow us to make money from now to infinity. You know, another informal culture rule was, my first or second day sitting there with 100 new associates was, you don't want to be on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, whether that's good or bad. It was a place that did not want superstars.
That's how Goldman has cultivated its mystique. At least for me, from a brand perspective.
That's changed and evolved over the years, but these are examples of culture is something that I don't think is as simple to say is either positive or negative.
Mm-hmm. When I think about it, it's like, what are the questions that you would ask if you were a consultant that came in to talk to any organization about their culture? You would be asking questions like, how do you do things? What are the things you guys say to each other that you know what it means that other people don't? I think you would be trying to draw out, as you have both cited, the ways that things get done. And that in the article comes out, like, we want to get things done, therefore we need a way to do it. Having a way is better than not having a way. I'm not so sure in this case that, like, culture is more than a good headline and a good soundbite, as much as a way of describing having momentum and vision and doing something and getting people to do it with you.
Yeah, that makes, I think that's such a good point, because I actually think that, I mean, this article is well written and has interesting data points and it's worth reading. And I'm not saying that to just sort of, you know, if I didn't like it, I'd tell you. It's a good article, but I think the whole frame of it, there's a problem there that reflects how we talk about culture to begin with. It's this sort of shallow addendum or add-on that kind of, because to me, like, the closer analogy is, I read recently there, and we've talked about this off air, not in recording, but Alistair Campbell, who is a former political advisor to Tony Blair, has a new book out called Winning, which is like, what creates winning cultures? And most of the examples are from sports. But the point he really makes that's really tight is, you have to have objective strategy and tactics, and you need them to kind of fit in a really tight way. Because if you don't know what your objectives are, then you don't know what your strategy is, and then your tactics don't fit your strategy. So every day, like, even in developing this podcast, it's like, well, this little promotion could be good, but does that fit to who we're speaking to? And then who we're speaking to, does that fit with our overall objectives? And I guess the point I'm making is that, to me, this article is much more in line with those types of questions than a real question about culture and what it is and how it forms an organization. So that we're raising important questions. This article raises important questions, but it's using a superficial conversation on culture to get to them, which reveals that we're still not talking about culture in a smart way.
Yeah. People don't really understand that culture is, is a language, and we refer to and we quote Grant McCracken in our piece, and I'm gonna paraphrase him now just for brevity. But when he talks about language is some culture is something that when it's like language in the sense that when we speak English or we speak whatever language we speak, it's not something we think about. We're not thinking right now that as we have this conversation, oh, I'm speaking English in a particular way and using certain dictions and syntax and whatever. It's natural to us. And culture can feel that way. It's when you are driving into new places, new opportunities, when you're looking to innovate, that the old way of thinking, the old sort of nomenclature that we've become accustomed to, you have to challenge yourself to push past that. And that's really a deeper, more insightful culture conversation that I think we don't get to when we're just framing in this didactic good, bad framework.
And Biz, you know? I mean, I obviously comment on everything, but the specific question I would have for you, and I guess for everybody, but for you now, is to do the kind of thing that the Grant McCracken quote points to, doesn't that kind of necessitate, you know, a quote unquote positive culture, if we want to use those words, or at least something that isn't like that's aiming towards something a little bit better, if that makes sense?
I think it's like a percentage wise, you know, it's hard to say absolutely one thing or the other.
Right.
Just taking a step back, I do agree with you that how things get done in terms of, you know, strategically thinking through goals, objectives, and tactics is definitely very interrelated with culture. But I think in the way that kind of the innovative, quote unquote, business media has really embraced the word culture, it has been as that like fourth pillar in that setup, which is to say, we can take a step back and look very clearly on the wall at what we're doing tactically, at what we're trying to do objectively and strategically. But are we actually fully aware of all of the ways that we get stuff done? And I think that culture is this bucket that's been created to say, oh, you know, this is the stuff we do with a wink and a nod. And I think the wink and the nod space is a really dangerous space to not start to make things clear as well.
Yeah.
Because even if you do want to say our culture is, you know, long-term greed or, you know, eat what you kill or something that's really aggro or really aggressive, you're at least being clear about what you think and what you want everyone to toe. And when you don't make that stuff explicit, it's the same in any culture, to your point about the stuff that we don't see. When the people who are inside cannot see what excludes those who are not allowed to participate, you have a really dangerous line there around what you're allowed to be, I think, for a business. You know, and to your question about don't you need good things, I absolutely think the point you made about toxicity is really important. Like, some people would die in an environment that's about treating each other like peers and listening to what everyone has to say. Some people right. want to be in a dog-eat-dog right. environment.
Definitely.
They want to be in that culture. That's right for them.
Definitely.
Other people don't want that. You know, other people, an environment with any sort of hierarchy gives them hives, right? So I think owning what culture is absolutely allows people to collect around the fires they want to be around, to build in the spaces they want to be building in. I think that's true. But I also think when you just like let it be a wink and a nod thing, then you're definitely not embracing as many people as you could, and you're not creating space for more people to come to the table.
I think that's very well put. I remember there's this book that came out many years ago called Vital Lies, Simple Truths by Daniel Goleman, which is all about like the psychology of self-deception. And I think that and maybe this is a benefit then of this article, which I've been fairly hard on, which is that, okay, even if it's going to be a quote unquote negative culture, let's at least articulate it and create a context for speaking about it and understanding it. But I think that what remains and what is problematic in the framing of it is that, and we've gone over this, no culture doesn't exist. I mean, yeah. Steve Jobs used that, you know, it was a great knock from a brand and kind of throwing shots perspective when he said, you know, Microsoft has no culture. And I was like, well, that sounds good and that's great positioning. But of course Microsoft has a culture. It's just Microsoft had a non-flashy, non-sexy, non-Apple culture. But right. It was like, you know, it's the middle class, big, you know, outlet store computer company. Yeah. that's a culture.
And these
you
are
cannot invade that. Yeah. It's a value judgment. And you can't evade it wherever you are. You can't evade the culture conversation.
And we confuse, I think we conflate culture for processes.
Mm.
You know, processes are not culture.
Right. Like that's what I was trying to get to with the Alistair Campbell
thing.
Yeah,
people walking in and having like a certain set of rules and guidelines in which to handle their behavior when within the office or to handle their workflow. Those are not necessarily culture issues. They can be part of culture, but they're not solely culture. So I think we confuse sometimes like this idea that something that's loose or doesn't have a certain set of regulations and rules to it as being a someplace that doesn't have culture. Like culture exists everywhere. You know, there's no way to get around that. Whether it's the boardrooms of Fortune 500 companies or it's prison systems have culture, you know, and one has to understand what those rules are, both formal and informal, and then navigate them in order to be successful. And I think we're probably going to get at this at the next segment, but I think culture,
that's how we do.
Yeah, culture. Culture.
There's a design to it. That's our culture. That's Dope Boys culture.
You know, and that's what's worrisome, that the argument of looking and assessing candidates, whether you're looking at someone coming into the organization new or people who are within the organization, oftentimes we use the blanket statement of like, oh, well, they just weren't a good culture fit.
That's a super loaded term.
Yeah, to just disqualify or to disqualify new people or to move out or not have new, you know, existing people come up within organizations. We just explain that by saying, well, they didn't fit the culture. They didn't get it, you know, and it's such a slippery slope when we kind of get into that type of conversation, you know.
Yeah, and that involves also another future conversation we'll have on the distinction between management and leadership, which dovetails with this. But that is what's up. Culture always matters, and culture always exists. So we're going to move on and get to what's good.
We want to pick it right back up with what's good.
Mm.
And what's good comes from HBR, Harvard Business Review, which had a really interesting article last week titled Women and Minorities Are Penalized for Promoting Diversity. And this was written by Stephanie K. Johnson and David R. Heckman for those who want to check it out in long form. But basically,
we'll have a link up to it as well.
Yeah, we'll have a link up on the website. But basically, the premise is that when you are a woman and a minority in a organization and you promote the tenets of diversity, even when those organizations are spaces that are favorable to diversity, you get linked and negatively reviewed as for promoting this. So it's sort of a weird thing where it's not like they're not penalizing you for promoting diversity in like saying diversity is good and you're being penalized for saying that. You're more so being cast and getting reviews with the same sort of stigma and stereotypes that you would get with those who are outside of the organization. So if the organization doesn't have many women or the organization doesn't have many African Americans or whatever, however you're managing or contextualizing minorities, you will be sort of cast with that same sort of shadow or pall that minorities would get just by trumpeting the tenets and benefits of having a diverse organization, which I thought was interesting, but also quite defeating if you're someone who is promoting having a more diverse workplace when there have been many studies also touted by places like Harvard Business Review. The Guardian has also written about this, just to name two, that cite having a diverse workplace as being a part of driving innovation, driving change, and driving you being a forward-thinking organization. So you basically have two disconnects, one being that studies have shown that having diverse organizations is a net positive, but yet those who are within organizations that themselves are diverse that trumpet diversity are penalized for that. So it's convoluted and complicated and somewhat depressing, but interesting as we think about what our workplaces are going to look like as we go forward.
When I first saw this headline, I was like, yeah, F that. I'm not even clicking that. I don't have time for that kind of distraction. Like being a woman, being a minority in a workplace, being a person of color in a workplace, being a disabled person in a workplace, like anything that could potentially other you in a workplace. There, you know, Google Scholar's got 12 pages of articles about how you're going to have something against you once you sit down at the table. So my initial reaction was like, great, another article for the pile. I do think that these pieces and this kind of awareness is probably most useful in, you know, like slip it under the pillow, tooth fairy style with those who are not representative of any sort of quote unquote othered group. Because if that is the case, if 85% of, you know, executive level positions are still being held by white men, then the keys are in their hands, right? So I brought up a woman named Joanna Barsh to mind. She worked with McKinsey for many years. She's been doing some collaborations with the LinkedIn groups, putting together videos around the concepts of centered leadership. But I went to an event that was, I was one of like five women in the space. We were all guests, business leaders, all white guys. And she was the guest speaker there basically to call them out on these issues. Not specifically this article, but the category of things that it's about. And her proposition to them was like, you know, this may make you uncomfortable. This may make you feel like this isn't what I want. Why do they keep pointing fingers at me? But if you are in the position to change things, then we got to start that conversation. So the hopefulness to me is that the awareness of these things may cause my, you know, shifts, whether they be seismic or minor, in the awareness of people who haven't had to, quote unquote, think about this. But I also think it's not surprising to see the piece come up.
Stop trying to take my jobs. My job. What? Sorry. Excuse me. I'm just looking at, you guys were staring at me so hard during the intro of this segment. No, I'm just playing. you should stare at Matt, too.
He's just off to the side.
Yeah, Matt's
readily with, as I with can the, see
with
everybody
the stealth white male privilege. What occurred to me, and again, if you go into Google Scholar or anything, that there's endless pieces like this. And this is a perspective for me in all of these conversations. I've mainly worked in startup or small environments. So I've never worked in, you know, a major corporation. Like I've done projects that involve them and I've done, you know, various things. But in terms of my own like work life, I've never worked at a mega organization. But what occurs to me, even on as smaller examples, whether you're talking about like college campus politics or in smaller organizations, it seems to me there's sort of like a deep version of this work and a shallow version of this work, right? I mean, there is, because a deeper version is going to put on the table conversations that people are going to be uncomfortable with. And not only just conversations, but like policies and strategies and things to implement to actually deal with these gaps, because I think ultimately some of these things are going to be overcome by just like muscling through certain changes, frankly, that just produce changes. And then you have to catch up with the changes, even if you're not ready for them yet. Conversely, I also think that this is where tools like, whether you want to talk about mindfulness or whatever else, like some of the inner capacities that allow for people to have, I don't totally like this word, but empathy or ability to deal with things that make them uncomfortable. I guess that's like the simplest thing, right? For some reason, I mean, I guess there's many reasons, obviously, this issue makes people extremely uncomfortable. And you have to disaggregate a lot of things simultaneously. When you move beyond the kind of like CEO and elite question of Harvard Business Review, I think one of the most tricky questions that's going to come up in a business environment, but even more generally, is how do you simultaneously, like as an example, tell, like, take a stereotypical Trump supporter, you know, a lower middle class white person who is certainly not in a position of economic or social privilege, and how do you simultaneously address like you're getting the rough end of many situations and you actually need to be delivered for. And at the same time, like, you're in a position of tremendous privilege that you don't even see. And both of those things are true simultaneously. So I just see this and I think, I don't know if I think anything very valuable other than it's extremely hard.
Yeah. And
yeah, I mean,
I think you nailed it with that talk about simultaneous truths.
Yeah.
You know, because there's an article written by The Guardian that's pretty basic. The headline, diverse workforces are more innovative. And they cite McKinsey and Company report, which basically says U.S. public companies with diversity on their executive board have a 95% higher return on equity than those without.
Absolutely.
So this is beyond the philosophical or the social. To those who are only driven by the financial, this is an obvious play toward having a better return on your investment or on your business model than you would have otherwise if you include diversity. And this is only speaking about the executive board, this McKinsey report. This doesn't even drift down into line workers and middle and upper management, which clearly lags behind in terms of having women and minorities represented. And I think that's the challenge where you're dealing with the reality of the results of these things while also faced with how people feel about them when they're dealing with them on a day-to-day basis. And there's a section out of the original report talking about women and minorities are penalized. They basically did a study citing a blind study where someone hires another worker who is a diverse candidate, meaning they're a woman or they're a minority, and whether the hiring manager, either a white male or someone from a diverse background. And what they found was that if a white male hired someone who was a diverse candidate, meaning a minority or a woman, there was no change in how that person was perceived. But if the person who was the hiring manager was themselves a woman or a minority and they hired another woman or minority, they were viewed as being less competent.
Right.
And that's really the rub. Right. You know, like, how do you manage knowing that diversity helps your organization, but yet, whether formally or informally, to go back to our first segment, punishing those who are champions of diversity that don't look like the standard, you know, the default, you know, white males.
And is that coming from some culture that inherently prioritizes the judgments towards white men? You know, like, I think that this absolutely weaves into the culture questions as well, because there are plenty of women or people of color who can tell you that their experience being managed by women or people of color who reflected their identity was more difficult than being managed by people with different identities. There's a lot of interesting research on, like, the difficulty that we do unto ourselves and to the people who seem to reflect us in the greater arena than we allow across, like, a mind the gap sense of distance, right? So that's interesting to me, what is being prioritized inherently in that. But also, like, diversity, the idea that a diverse workplace would be more profitable should be common sense. There's really good, interesting double segment that on This American Life about the research on diversity in schools and how a diverse educational setting improves the educational outcomes of the kids. Like, if you're a farmer, you don't want to be planting one seed in the same soil over and over. If you're trying to build your retirement profile, you know, stock portfolio, you do not want to invest all of it in one business or one industry. Like, the concept of diversity in so many parts of how we learn about the world is the baseline necessity for how it moves things forward. So the idea that it would not be true in a for-profit environment is silly and oversimplified and insane. But then the question becomes, okay, if diversity is important, then, like, how does it work? To your point about, is it shallow? you know, I was watching The Office, American Office, a little while ago, and watched the diversity episode. Like, they do the shallow diversity play really well.
Yes.
And, you know, work is hard. Life is hard. You know, like, Russian literature wouldn't exist without that being a true statement. I think the idea that it's going to be difficult to do things should be a baseline assumption about how things get done. But how do you start that conversation?
No, but I think that's... That's so funny when you're talking about retirement portfolio. I just had this image of like Matt and I, it's whether I'd be like, white men, sturdy, reliable, your retirement. But I think it's like, but is that image partially? And I guess what I meant by deep and shallow is I think like, of course you're right that the deep is always more challenging. But I think that, you know, there is this kind of, The Office does it perfectly. Everybody can understand. Everybody can learn the slogans. Everybody can, you know, mouth the talking points. But the real implications of actually reforming and reorienting these things include, you know, just such a basic reorientation that a lot of people, and, you know, like, let's be specific, a lot of like white people and a lot of white dudes are not comfortable with. And right. That is really striking to me. I don't know why certain people are, you know, there's a lot of variables in why people are willing to make certain leaps or not. But it also occurs to me in the context of this conversation that even the truism that of course diversity increases profitability and of course diversity increases, you know, cultural output and everything. I mean, it's so mind-blowingly obvious, but this is also a country where in the 1990s, The Bell Curve was a major bestseller and a book that was quoted in and excerpted in like the New Republic, which is a quote unquote liberal magazine at that time, explicitly made the argument that essentially black people were intellectually inferior. So like this, it did. I mean, I'm trying to be as journalistic and give them the caveats that they gave themselves as well. But yes, that is essentially the argument
like
they
made.
Like,
why are we having this conversation?
So this is in the bloodstream. We've had this conversation constantly. So we think that's the other thing that comes up in all of these places, that even if people have been trained to say this and that, the deep version is, well, do you believe the bell curve? You know, the deep version is, do you want to even just have a conversation where it's like, maybe it's just not a good look on your part and it's not in some big melodramatic way, but you're going to get shifted and redirected.
And the bell curve worked because there's assumptions, you know, you know, most of the times we don't work with formalized ways of thinking. We're not getting resumes. We're not getting like all the information. So I think about, and this might be far afield, but the otherness that happens all the time. Like, why was the birther movement so successful with someone like Obama? Because you can make the argument, as crazy it might seem to some people, but to a whole segment of the population that perceives anything that is not within their purview as being other, which means it's open to being questioned, whether that's a function of its legitimacy or its competence, you know. And there's a section of the article which I'll read real quick, which says, we know that in the U.S. there's still a power and status gap between men and women and between whites and non-whites. High status groups, mainly white men, are given freedom to deviate from the status quo because their competence is assumed based on their membership in the high status group. In contrast, when women and non-white leaders advocate for other women and non-whites, it highlights their low status demographics, activating the stereotype of incompetence and leads to worse performance ratings.
And you see that just real quick in the model minority conversation too. I remember many years ago reading an article in The Economist that, you know, explicitly played off of like, you know, Asians show up and they kind of do everything right. So why can't black people do it? I mean, that's basically the argument.
Yeah.
Again, and journalistically, that's not exactly what it said, but that was basically what the argument was. And so then, and even that, you see the flip side, which is like, you can either, when you're outside the quote unquote norm, you either play the rules perfectly and then you're elevated, or you deviate, and that's entirely unacceptable. And
right, when the rules are held by one group, then they're held by one group. I do want to say one quick thing. Yeah. You know, I think this question has come up a lot in the growth of the tech sector, and like, what does real diversity look like? There's a lot of great writing about it, but also a lot of just like very long Medium pieces that say nothing. And the frank truth is that diversity, you know, for women to be in tech space with for a very long time was like a non-starter or a very invisible reality, and absolutely like massive failure in the tech sector to have people of color hold and continue to rise up in a meaningful way. Like, it, yes, there are very tokenistic examples that we can call out, but it is a massive failure. There was an interesting article I saw in VentureBeat on March 20th by Teresa Namasani, I think is how you say her last name, who's at Microsoft, talking about like, what does it really look like to diversify a tech business? Why would you do it? What would you do with it? But the context that I had that conversation with a friend in was, okay, fine, but if all of the money is coming from VCs and that's what's driving the way these companies get shifted, and VCs are like 92% white men, even if there's diversity amongst the white men in the way they're doing stuff, like how the frame is just already set. Yeah. And I think this is also true in the nonprofit sector. You know, just because people toe the line on having politics that would reflect a desire for diversity doesn't mean that white women are dominating that space in a way that's racist. It doesn't mean that like there isn't some of that stuff absolutely still happening. So how do we do diversity, I think, is a bigger question that we need to think about, not just are we doing diversity.
Yeah, there's internalizing something and discoursing something,
and that's what's good.
We spent far too much time on that topic for me to be comfortable.
Dude.
Now we want to jump to digging into crates, and this is our time where we can hip everybody to something that we as a crew have found that is interesting, that's cool, that may or may not be on your radar, but if it's not, we want to point it out. And we really, you know, to use that old hip hop euphemism, we're going to be digging into crates and bringing that to you. So I'm going to start off real quick with just two quick things, one of which anyone, no matter where you are, can check out. And I'm a big nerd, blurred, black nerd. And
yes, you are.
I've been collecting comics and comics since I was a kid. And there's one book that I really love, and it's called Saga. And it's popularly known as a space opera fantasy set of issues and graphic novels. You can get them collected in big format. Written by Brian K. Vaughan and illustrated by Fiona Staples. And I don't want to give too much of the story away, but it's a story around conflict, around love, around two cultures coming together to create a life, and the way the narrative plays itself out. It's really interesting. So for those of you who have an appetite to delve into the fantastic, I would definitely recommend Saga. And the other quick thing is, as a Brooklynite, I went to the Brooklyn Museum this past weekend and checked out the Agitprop show at the Brooklyn Museum, which is a collection of media and propaganda that highlights the convolution or the connection of the worlds between media and politics from disenfranchised communities. And it runs through August 7th, 2016. So if you're in Brooklyn, I definitely recommend you checking that out. And it's called Agitprop. And it's a long-running exhibit, and it's really great. So cop that.
The Lives of Others. It's an amazing German film. I've been thinking a lot about surveillance, and that's something that's present for all of us. It's great to see and disturbing to see a kind of like analog surveillance in action. And in a way, how it's so much more under the East German system, which is where this film takes place, it's obviously so much more invasive. But at the same time, what we're facing today is a lot more impersonal, and therefore it doesn't leave personal discretion, which this movie explores. It kind of explores whether a Stasi agent can sort of have conscience and how conscience is sort of aroused. And it's just a beautifully made, stellar movie that has some interesting implications for stuff that's hitting us all today. So Lies of Others.
Recently was asked by a friend for a book list, so I was digging in my own crates to pull out some titles. And the first book that really hit a chord for me was Zami, A Spelling of My Name by Audre Lorde. Very famous queer black feminist thought leader. Phenomenal book about her life and identity in general. Definitely recommend. It's an incredibly melodic book. Definitely Zami. Check it out. Other book that came up is a story that's actually journalistic by Dan Baum called Nine Lives. It's an exploration of nine people's lives in New Orleans, definitely centered around the hurricane, but goes back to their births. And I think it's a really beautiful storytelling piece, as well as a chance to look at the socio-political issues that are obviously native to New Orleans, but perhaps to our whole country. And then a flick. I recently rewatched Rambo 2. And nice. I think everyone else should too.
Wow, you can't prep for the crates.
Yeah, the crates are full, man.
You can't, like, yeah, the crate, people are gonna like lugging
load,
it up.
You load them up in the yeah, back of the van.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the truth. Matt Leck, thank you so much. Our super producer.
What?
Biz Gormley, thank you so much for joining us. Looking forward to having you back on again soon.
Likewise, nice to be here.
Our crew member for this week, thank you so much. Brilliant as always. Phil, my friend.
The sign-off,
my
BK paisan. Forever.
Email us at 2DopeBoysBK@gmail.com. Check us out at 2DopeBoysPod.com. That's spelled out. You can find out more about our consulting work. You can read bios of all of our crew. There's a lot to find out there, so check us out there and email us. Biz, where can people find you?
Definitely check me out on Twitter and Instagram. I'm a visual geek, so on Instagram it's BIZZYGI, Busy G. And on Twitter, One Witness, spelled out OneWitness. Would love to start conversations with folks on there.
Thanks, everybody. See you all on Thursday for On Point.
Peace.